time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, happy new year to everybody. Welcome back to the show. We had a great holiday season, and we're ready to kick off 2011 with a great set of guests and some fascinating topics. We're going to talk today about anti-corruption efforts at the World Bank, along with the future of higher education, and also talk a little bit about the latest goings-on in North Korea. But with a new Congress having been sworn in yesterday, a historic day as Republicans took power in the House of Representatives and Democrats narrowly controlled the United States Senate, we wanted to kick off by talking about one of the hot issues on Capitol Hill these days, and that is the world of appropriations and the dreaded word earmarks. And joining us to talk about that, two lobbyists from the law firm of Patton Boggs here in Washington, D.C., Amy Budner and Pam Welsh. Ladies, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Great, thank you.
Well, Amy, let's start with you. Tell me a little bit about where we stand with the earmarking process and what maybe some of the most common misperceptions you deal with on a day-in and day-out basis are with that whole thing.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kevin. Well, as we know, there are many popular myths out there about the appropriations process in general and earmarking. So I'm going to take you through just a couple of quick examples and talk about why try to debunk some of those myths. The first is that doing away with earmarks basically will reduce the federal budget. It's not really the case right now, and instead, when earmarks are eliminated from spending bills, that money actually gets turned back to the administration, and agencies are able to direct spending at their discretion. Republicans are looking to address this issue in their newly adopted rules package yesterday through what they call spending reduction accounts. Earmark spending actually accounts for a very small percentage of overall discretionary spending and has actually declined in recent years. So even if these new spending reduction accounts end up applying to all earmarks, there won't actually be much of an impact on the overall budget. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of those new rules passed and how that all affect earmarks later. But that's kind of generally the first myth. The second myth is that congressional earmarks are just pet projects of members. They typically, think that they directly benefit members of Congress or their families, but that's not usually really the case at all. It's generally the exception and not the rule. And even though we've all kind of read the headlines about congressional scandals related to earmarks, recently important reforms have been put in place to address many of these and to make them more, the process more transparent and accountable. And in fact, after the infamous Alaskan Bridge to Nowhere scandal in 2007, Congress began implementing much more strict transparency rules, and all earmark projects must be subjected to these rules. So in addition to identifying each earmark and the member who requested it in the text of each appropriations bill, congressional rules now also require members to publicize the projects they sponsor as well as certify they have no financial interest in them, even if those earmarks don't make it into the final bill. So that's just the second typical myth. Another point I'd like to make about that one is that the vast majority of earmark accounts are actually in the areas of public infrastructure, social services, education, law enforcement, projects that typically support local governments and other public and nonprofit agencies, not necessarily, they don't actually go to individuals or corporations. So
interesting rebutting a couple of the very common myths. And you've mentioned earmark reform, so let me turn to Pam and ask her to talk a little bit more about what that looks like today and what you think it's going to look like going forward.
Sure. As we know, there's obviously been a very loud earmark for making the ban on earmarks permanent, but that's not likely that they're going to be gone forever. Most likely we'll see Congress forego earmarks for 1 year, maybe even two, while addressing additional reforms.
That's an important point because I think people don't pick up carefully enough on the fact that Congress has imposed a moratorium, which by its very definition suggests merely a timeout as opposed to something that's permanent.
Exactly. And even with a loud argument leading up to the election, Republicans did not address earmarks specifically in the rules package that was adopted yesterday. They did implement some additional budget reforms, but they didn't specifically put in a formal rule, although the leadership decisions will enforce the moratorium, as we've discussed throughout the 112th Congress. So Amy mentioned some of the reforms that we've already seen in recent years. So, you know, what else is out there to do? We saw some proposals last year that were submitted by members of Congress that included a continuation of the ban against earmarks for for-profit entities, which we saw the House Democrats impose, a sort of one-stop online searchable public database of proposed projects, similar to what the members are currently doing on their own websites, but providing a bit more detail about the projects, the amounts requested, the amounts approved, a little more information about the requestors themselves, some procedural changes to allow amendments and points of order against spending bills, and public disclosure of those bills prior to committee action. And just before the election, there was a group of lobbyists and budget watchdog groups, which don't usually join forces, but they got together and they proposed five earmark reforms that we may see come up this year in some draft legislation. Those included the one-stop database, as I previously mentioned. They also included a limit of earmarks directed to campaign contributors, barring of legislative staff from fundraising activities, a random audit of earmarks by the GAO, a certification that earmark recipients can handle and complete the proposed project. And we also saw a measure last year that I certainly don't think is going to get a lot of traction in a Republican House, but we saw a proposal for what would essentially account to a line item veto for the president on spending bills that would then have to be sent back to Congress for an up or down vote. But as I said, I don't think that's going to get a lot of traction in this Congress.
Well, I know this is a big part of your professional practice. Tell me a little bit about the advice that you're giving to folks that have been engaged in this process before. I know you primarily represent units of local government and colleges, universities, hospital systems, cultural institutions, transportation entities. Tell me a little bit about what advice you give to them to go through this very unique and different process this year.
Yeah, hi, this is Amy, and I guess I'll just say that the biggest impact that it'll have on us this year for most of our clients is that it'll lead to, you know, the House moratorium is really going to lead to a Senate-only strategy for the year, and because many senators will continue to advance projects going forward, you know, we're recommending that our clients do put forth a strategy for the fiscal year 2012 and, put forth an agenda to their members. Now, we may see some issues with what ultimately happens during the conference process on any of the spending bills and whether earmarks are then retained, but many senators will certainly be at least accepting projects.
And I think regardless of how the appropriations process itself pans out and despite anticipated cuts in domestic programs, it's important to note that federal funding will still flow to the general public, although it'll be through federal departments and agencies via competitive and discretionary opportunities, similar to what we saw in fiscal year 2007. So we plan to work with our clients to develop a broader and more aggressive agency approach to securing federal funding and also proactively engaging with Congress to advocate against cuts and policy changes that may impact the amount of federal dollars that flow to our clients through formula grants and other means as well.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that. I mean, it seems to be one of the ironies of ending the earmarking process is you get a process where the agencies distribute money largely outside of the control of Congress, and any influence that Congress exerts over the agency to fund a particular project, presumably in their home state or district, is actually now sort of off the public radar screen, very difficult to disclose and for people to know who's pushing for this. Tell me a little bit about that.
Right, and that's, you know, it's a less transparent process than the appropriations process, which is another argument for why the earmarking process should continue and why members, I think, will, you know, question the moratorium as they continue this year. The agencies still receive the money. We don't think the agencies will be making a lot of their funding decisions this year until after the March 4th continuing resolution ends, and we anticipate Congress will somehow resolve the FY11 funding process. But then those agencies will receive funds, as we saw in FY2007, where, as you remember, all earmarks were cut out of the bills that year as well. The agencies sometimes implemented new programs, sometimes boosted funding that they had in current programs. Those decisions will depend a great deal on how the funding levels are set for the FY11 bills. So we expect to see some agency solicitations coming out, you know, in the April-May timeframe.
And, of course, those solicitations have to get done before the end of the fiscal year for the government, end of September, right?
Correct. The award money has to be issued before September 30th. So a lot of times the agencies will cut it toward the end in September there, but they'll put out solicitations, probably April, May, June.
Interesting. So because of how they're working things this year, maybe less time for folks to participate. Amy, let me let you jump back in and add any thoughts on what the Senate's going to do or how this process will play out or any additional advice. We've got about a minute left.
Sure. Well, as we've seen, some senators have already put some emails out there advising their constituents on what to do going forward this year. And, it looks like most Democrats who at least voted against the ban last fall will be accepting projects, although they've noted that it'll be a much more rigorous process, probably a lot fewer earmarks in the FY12 spending bills. And that'll obviously have an impact on everyone who's applying and the quality of projects that that get advanced.
Interesting. Anything else, Pam, before we wrap things up?
Nope. I think that concludes my comment.
Well, great. Amy Budner and Pam Welsh have joined us. If you have questions about the appropriations process, federal funding in general, encourage you to contact them. They can be reached at A. Budner, A-B-U-D-N-E-R, at pattenboggs.com, or P. Welsh, P-W-E-L-S-H, at pattenboggs.com. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk a little bit about anti-corruption efforts at the World Bank. Keep it here on Capital Thinking.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202- 2-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The house will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from
from Washington. It's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, one of the things we talked a lot about in 2010 were banking and financial services issues. And, of course, it's been an interesting couple of years for that sector of the economy. A lot of concern about how money is spent and whether or not there's corruption and fraud. And one of the things we haven't done is take a look at that from an international perspective. So here to join us today is a leading litigator from Washington, D.C., John Oberdorfer, who was on a panel that the World Bank had in early December on global anti-corruption and fraud issues around the world, talking about increasing stringent sanctions that the World Bank was going to impose on those corruption cases. So, John, welcome back. I know we've had you on before, and why don't you tell us a little bit, educate us from the start about what role the World Bank actually plays as a lender in global anti-corruption and fraud prevention issues.
Kevin, it's a pleasure to be with you today. The World Bank, when you look at the numbers, the World Bank is quite extraordinary. They commit each year $72 billion in contracts, some 100,000 contracts around the world. And they try to police that in terms of anti-corruption. They face situations where there's bribery or fraud or other forms of corruption. And beginning in the mid-1990s, when Jim Wolfensohn was the head of the bank, he made a very seminal speech where he talked about the cancer of corruption and launched a program where the bank was going to try and do something about that, first on the theory that it was their money and they wanted to make sure it was spent properly, but then much more broadly in terms of how corruption affected the societies that they were trying to assist, and that it was very necessary to try and make anti-corruption part of their program, just like it was trying to focus on health and infrastructure and other issues. So beginning in the mid-90s, they instituted a program which has grown and developed over the last 15 or 16 years in sophistication and scope, and it's done so while other programs, other statutes, other countries, like our Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, the UK's Bribery Act, actions by the UN, by the OECD, all of those have spawned too. So there's now quite a system of anti-corruption efforts at various efforts in various directions. And theirs is directed to their contracts. They don't have any criminal or civil enforcement authority. What they do is they will suspend someone who is found to have engaged in anti-corruptive activities. They'll suspend them from future bank contracts and from contracts with all the other related banks, and they will notify the national authorities from where the corruption took place, and there may be enforcement actions coming out of that. But
yeah, talk to me about that. I mean, it seems like so the you got this worldwide network of banks and, of course, governments with different standards and different laws. So how does the World Bank actually get engaged and notified about a corruption or fraud case? And then how do they start the legal process or even just the regulatory slash business process of intervening in those cases?
Well, they don't intervene in any case. They start up their own cases in terms of whether they're going to allow someone to continue to be a World Bank contractor, and if they find that there is a violation, there is a situation there, then they will notify the SEC here, the Department of Justice here, and leave it to them to, if they want to take any further steps. The cases they have are initiated by a complaint or a hotline or whatever it may be. That they get information that there's trouble on a particular contract or with a particular contractor, and they then proceed their large force is power is to notify the public, and they post a list of those who've been debarred. And you know, well, for a company, that's pretty damaging.
Sure, I can imagine that hurts your reputation and your ability to do business. Tell me who some of the key players are, and you know, other than posting this notice, what kind of sanctions can they impose?
Well, their sanctions are, you know, their primary sanction is to bar you from being able to do business with the World Bank, with and then under agreement that was reached in April of 2010, that extends to the related banks like the Inter-American Development Bank and the Asian Development Bank and other banks like that. So that is the extent of their authority. As I say, it spills over. And they've had some notable cases. They, like many of the other enforcement authorities, dealt with the Siemens situation, and Siemens entered into an agreement where they would pay the bank $100 million over 15 years, and one of their entities was barred, and they agreed not to compete for World Bank contracts for several years. So, and Siemens was the subject of a number of other actions by governmental entities.
Interesting. Well, so other than Siemens being mentioned, are there other big notable recent developments in this area?
Well, the recent developments are, you know, sort of within the bank's world. They have a relatively new person who's ahead of their enforcement efforts, who's made it clear that he's going to try to focus the bank's efforts in this area on the big guys. And that this is Leonard McCarthy, who's the head of their integrity section. I think that over the years, when you look through the list of those who've been debarred, for the most part, they have been smaller contractors, sometimes entities that exist today and don't exist tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But they're trying to make sure that entities that have the largest share here are hewing the line, and if there are problems there, they want to make sure that they focus it in that direction.
So, talk to me from a legal perspective. What the implications are? You got a World Bank that seems to be sort of stepping out and becoming more aggressive, and you have, of course, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act here in the United States, where it also seems like the Justice Department for the last several years has made that a growing point of emphasis. So as a legal practitioner, what are some of the issues you worry about now that you didn't worry about before?
Well, I think, more importantly, as a business person doing business internationally, you need to worry about these various statutes and the World Bank's program. And I think that as a lawyer, you need to look at them holistically, and that it used to be, when I first started doing World Bank matters, that what was going on at the World Bank in their enforcement area was really within the walls of the bank, and it never got outside except to be for a listing of debarment, but there was no coordination with the Justice Department or a counterpart in another country. And it was sort of a separate silo, if you will. I think now the situation has changed. There is coordination. There is communication by the bank people with these other enforcement entities. A practicing lawyer needs to be taking into account what happens at the bank, what happens under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, under the UK Bribery Act, whatever it may be. But to look at it holistically, they've got different. They all have different procedures. The bank has got its own procedures. They're not really designed for a civil criminal enforcement scheme, so you have to figure out how to navigate it with the backdrop of possible civil or criminal enforcement activities by a national government. So it's more complicated than it used to be.
Well, John, I know that you had this first conference here in Washington, D.C. in early December, but there are really three conferences tied to this issue. So tell me a little bit about the other two, when they're coming up, and what topics are on the agenda.
please do that. We put together what we call a conference, a series of conferences on a trilogy of perils. And the first one we did in conjunction with the World Bank and its staff, and that was a very successful event on December 2 over at the bank, and it focused, of course, on the bank's activities. The second one, which is coming up on January 17th, will be held here at Patton Boggs, and it's going to focus on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and the UK Bribery Act, which it will go into effect in March. And we'll have a panel of experts on that, both from here and from the UK. And the third one will be in March, I believe it's March 9th, and that's going to look at sort of broader aspects of the anti-corruption situation, how it spills over into international arbitration, how it affects the various forms of political insurance that are available from both from the bank and from other agencies, and also focus on steps that companies can take to protect themselves, compliance programs that would, what constitutes a compliance program that can help a company either isolate or the risk that they have here from an errant employee to, making sure that their corporate culture is in line with what these agencies are looking for. And so it will focus on that.
Well, John, in wrapping up, how do you register for the conference?
Oh, very easy. You can send an email to me or to Jay Darden at our firm, and we'll be glad to have anybody who wants to attend. It starts at 8 on the morning of the 19th of January here at our offices at 2550M, and we would we welcome anyone who would like to come. It's free of charge, and we look for a very stimulating.
Well, let's leave it there. In interest of time, we'll save Jay Darden, J-D-A-R-D-E-N, at PattenBoggs.com.
Yes, John Oberdorfer, J-Oberdorfer at PattenBoggs.com.
We'll be back in just a moment with more Capital Thinking.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoe Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoe Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio, every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, one of the topics we haven't talked about in a while on the show, but one that we think is going to be increasingly important in the next 2 years here in Washington, is the state of higher education in America. President Obama gave a very high-profile speech back in August of 2010 where he called for the creation of 8 million more college graduates by 2020. And that's a very large hill for us to climb in improving our competitiveness worldwide. In order to do that, we're going to see the continued growth of what we call the non-traditional students and a different kind of higher education system than we've had perhaps in the past, with some new approaches required. So we brought in Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities President Harris Miller to talk to us a little bit about the unique contributions that private sector colleges and universities bring to the mix of higher education. So Harris, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Kevin. Thanks for having me on.
Well, talk to us a little bit about the association first, who the members are, and what kind of programs do they typically offer to students today?
Well, they're probably the least understood portion of higher education. Most of us think of higher education, we either think of our mega state university systems, the Ohio States and the Penn States, or we think of our elite private universities, our Harvards and Yales and Stanfords, or our more religiously oriented institutions, or we think of our community college system. What we don't think about are the schools that I represent, namely schools that are for-profit, which means that not only do they have to make a profit each year, but they also pay taxes on it. But the biggest difference really, Kevin, is that our schools are very much oriented toward preparing people for the workforce. In many cases, people who don't have particular skills at all, and they really need skills to be part of this 21st century workforce, or people who already have skills that either need them updated or upgraded in order to get ahead. And our student population, which is now 12% of all of higher education, which has come as a shock to most people, but our student population is, as you suggested, primarily those non-traditional students, not the 18 to 22-year-old who comes directly out of high school and is using the 4 years of college to transition from teenhood to early adulthood. But instead, our students tend to be in their late 20s. Most of them are working, about 76% of them are working. Almost 50% of them have children. So these are people who either didn't go on to college, perhaps they went into the military, or they tried college and it wasn't for them. And now they've woken up at the age of 26 or 27 or 28 and said, you know what, I'm just not getting ahead. Either I don't have a job at all, or I'm in a dead-end job, and I need a specific set of talents, whether it be in an area like healthcare, nursing, or other healthcare jobs, whether it be in information technology, business. It has to be an education that directly relates to the job market. You can't get a general liberal arts degree. You can't get, like I had, a philosophy undergraduate degree, or my daughter had a music degree. My son has a classics and English degree. Those are all great degrees, but that's not the kind of program we offer. We offer programs that directly relate to people getting jobs or advancing their careers.
Well, tell me a little bit, from a public perception, how do you differ? You talked a little bit about the Stanfords, Harvards, Notre Dames of the world, but how do you differ from a community college, which I think many people think of first when they think of the non-traditional or less traditional student and where they might start out their educational path in higher education?
There's definitely some overlap with community colleges to the extent that community colleges are career-focused, but community colleges perform multiple functions, as you know. Some of them see themselves as feeding grounds into the traditional four-year higher education system. Some of their functions involve serving the local community by providing, for example, English as second language courses or programs for retired and senior citizens. So they perform a multiplicity of functions. And they also are, of course, heavily directly subsidized by the state governments and often by the local community. So the actual price tag paid by the student is relatively low because the taxpayer is heavily subsidizing that student. Our schools only serve one function. We don't have all those other functions beyond the career education. We also adhere to trying to serve the student where he or she really fits into the lifestyle. Most community colleges, though some of them are changing, have, their school year the same as a traditional school year, which is at 9 months of the year,
sure.
September through May, maybe a few weeks off in the winter.
A calendar set up when kids had to have the summer off to harvest.
Exactly. Our schools are designed to meet the needs of the students, and our students are not interested in taking those summers off. They want to get that education under their belt. They want to make sure they get that sheepskin, pass any certifications or exams they have to get into the workforce. So we go school year-round, June, July, and August, just three more months of the year, not 3 months of vacation or summertime off. Our programs are offered morning, noon, and night. The community college may have the biology course available from 9 to 11 on Mondays and Wednesdays because that's when the faculty person has made herself or himself available. We'll offer that same biology course 9 to 11, 1 to 3, 6 to 8 in the evening, and maybe weekends too, because we're trying to meet the student schedule, not the faculty schedule. We also, from day one, focus on job placement. Again, some of the community colleges are coming in this direction, but we really start that from the beginning, teaching people how to fill out resumes, giving them internships and externships, helping them meet the marketplace so they really are prepared to go right into the job market.
Gotcha. Well, tell me a little bit, sort of a two-sided question here, a little bit about, obviously you've got for-profit players here, but how do the costs for going to one of your schools stack up with what people would consider a more traditional education, and how do you balance that with the benefits that are provided to students in a for-profit environment?
Well, there are two different terms here we have to get clear. One is cost and one is price. As I mentioned, community colleges, state colleges, and universities have these substantial subsidies from taxpayers. So those subsidies are being cut in many cases because the states themselves are having these enormous financial difficulties that we're all aware of. But on average, a student in a community college is getting a $10,000 to $12,000 per student subsidy, which we don't get at our schools. In fact, not only do we not get a subsidy, we actually have to pay taxes. The business has to pay taxes. So the revenue that a career school gets is directly from the student, and the student has to get that money either from his or her own resources, from grants, or from loans. And so the actual price may be the same. In fact, a lot of studies have shown that the price to deliver the education, equivalent education, is actually less at our institutions because we are more efficient by teaching year-round, for example. But the price the student pays, the cost the student pays at a community college or state college may appear lower because you don't take into account the subsidy. So it is a different way of delivering, but in both circumstances, the taxpayer is paying either by loaning the student money, in our case, which the student has to pay most of that back, and in fact, the government does make a profit on student loans, as you know, or the other way around, which is not so much directly to the student, but directly to the institutions.
Well, talk to me a little bit about what are the challenges that you face in providing more access to a class of students that typically hasn't gone the higher education route. What challenges are you facing today with the federal government?
Well, the challenge of the federal government is we understand that our sector, just like all of higher education, needs to be heavily regulated. We're talking about a lot of taxpayers' dollars, billions of dollars. We're talking about potentially vulnerable consumers, students. But sometimes the department goes overboard. Right now they have a proposal on the table called the Gainful Employment Proposed Rule, which would lead to the closure of thousands of programs and put millions of students on the street. You mentioned at the top of this segment that the president wants to have 8 million more students with degrees by the end of this decade. Well, his proposal, at least his department's proposal, if implemented, would, according to independent studies, knock over 2 million students out on the street between now and the end of the decade. Well, those two numbers simply don't jibe. You can't, on the one hand, try to increase the number of graduates at the same time you're cutting capacity. So we've got to get the department to understand that their gainful employment proposal is a very badly conceived and misdirected policy. It's not going to do what they want, which is to get at the bad schools and the bad programs. All it's going to do is knock off access for literally millions of students who are highly desirous of getting an education.
Gotcha. And we've got just about a minute left. Tell us where people can find out a little more information, Harris, about the system and how they can find the right educational institution for them and their hopes and dreams for the future.
Go to our website, apscu.org, APSCU.org. We have information there that helps them to find out about our schools, or go to websites like College Finder or FinAid.org, where they can learn more. Not every student belongs in a career college any more than every student belongs at Harvard, but we really encourage students to shop around because they may find our school fits exactly the need that they have, fits their desire, and fits their position in life today.
Not every student belongs at Harvard. That actually sounds a lot like the ding letter I got from Harvard back in the day, Harris. So we'll have to leave it at that. This is a fascinating topic. There is a lot going on with the gainful employment rule, and I think we'll want to have you back on sometime to talk a little bit more about that in detail and some of the challenges of the regulatory state that are bearing down on the higher education world in the Obama administration. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about repressive rule and the potential for change in North Korea. We'll be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, I made a little Sarah Palin-esque sort of mistake going into the segment, going into the commercial break, saying we were going to talk about South Korea when really we're going to talk about
right.
the oppressive regime of North Korea. And joining us is Hwan Kim, who is the head of the Korean practice at the law firm of Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., a native Korean himself. And Hwan, tell us a little bit. We've all just had a great holiday season, but I imagine in the repressive world that is North Korea, a holiday season passed, a new year passed, perhaps unnoticed and uncelebrated because of what's going on up there right now.
It's a tough place to live, for sure. And given the increased tension in the last part of the year, I doubt there was any let-up. For the benefit of the listeners, I thought it was sort of important to give a brief background about North Korea and South Korea and how they compare.
Please, go ahead.
If you look at, for example, GNP per capita between the difference between South Korea and North Korea is that South Korea is about 37 times bigger GNP. And if you look at per capita, it's for South Korea, it's about $17,000 per person. North Korea is $960. If you look at the population, South Korea is about 48 million. North Korea is about 24. If you look at the life expectancy, South Korea is about 80 years per person. North Korea is about 68. So, you know, the two countries contrast dramatically in terms of the world that they live in. And it's interesting when you look at the media, the focus being on the military, people forget that there is a huge difference between these two countries.
Absolutely. Well, I think kind of the baseline question everybody always asks is, how does North Korea hold on just so long, as isolated as they are, and can they really survive going forward?
That's an interesting question. Despite the belligerence that was seen last year, and you've seen the United States, China, and Japan, and obviously South Korea all worried about what may happen, there seems to be sort of an understanding that a unification under South Korea's rule is a possibility. Now, that was a surprising thought that was coming forward, listening and reading the press reports, that thought was being floated widely in presses in these countries. And there is some belief that despite North's internal unity, that given the anointment of the youngest Kim Jong-un, who's 20-something, nobody really knows exactly how old he is, whether that regime would survive. I mean, the current leader, Kim Jong-il, is very sick. And if he had a stroke a couple of years back, and I think that's the reason why that he's trying to rush the succession of his third son. It's his youngest son who's being.
Juan, I have to ask you. So, if you're one of the older sons, aren't you a little bit ticked off that your little brother's the heir to the throne and you're not?
And I think that's part of the tension that's being raised. I mean, it appears that the second son likes video games too much. That came out in the press somewhere. But it isn't clear whether there is family unity on the succession. So, whether or not the youngest Kim succeeds his father would depend on a number of different things. First would be his father's health. Would he be around long enough to ensure that his son successfully gets the power that he's trying to get, and whether there's a family support and whether the military will support it.
I see. Well, tell me a little bit. So, obviously, with North Korea, the country that has the most influence over them is China, and here you have North Korea sort of continuing to play a bait and switch on the development of a nuclear weapons program. And
right.
Why is China the mega power in the region, and obviously one of the world's dominant powers, allowing a nuclear power to grow up, on its border that frankly they may not be able to control as well as they'd like?
You know, that's a question I think a lot of people have been asking, and that's the right question to ask. If you look back historically, China's involvement in Korea has often been very disastrous. You know, you go back to the 17th century, you know, China was trying to get unified. They wanted Korea to submit. The Koreans didn't submit. China decided to invade Korea, and you know, it was a disaster, and the country fell apart. Happened in the 19th century. It happened in the 1950s when you know, China decided to get involved in the Korean War. It lost many people, many soldiers, and that had a huge economic repercussion on China. And so, you know, Chinese, I think, are rightfully sort of concerned about a war on the Korean Peninsula or where they're forced to get involved. And, you know, the United States still has 28,000 soldiers on ground in South Korea. So, you know, if hostilities breaks out, it's a terrible situation for China. So I could see them trying to, you know, maintain a status quo, trying to make sure everything is calm. My friends at the State Department were joking that PRC stood for "Please Remain Calm."
Yeah, you know, a couple of interesting comments. You won your video game comment about the middle son. It's always interesting that dictators that you know, disparage the West tend to have all their creature comforts come from there. Tell me a little bit. So obviously, there's been some incidents with South Korea and a couple of, I don't want to say insurgencies, but, you know, a couple of military incidents in the last few months there. And how is South Korea responding, and is it different than what they've done in the past?
It's very different. They appointed a defense minister by the name of Kwon Jin Kim. He studied in the German Military Academy. And he graduated from there, which was kind of unique. He had a different philosophy about responding to Korea, which was you just can't let them get away with their aggressiveness. That you know, South Korea need not just respond in kind or in the same proportion. There is no such rule. And that didn't sit well in the past with the politicians who wanted to keep things calm. But realizing that, you know, reacting passively didn't really calm down North Koreans. President Lee had appointed General Kim to become the defense minister, who's much more hawkish. And I think that has a that's having a repercussion. Defense Minister Kim insisted on having the military exercise where the North Koreans had you know, bombed, shot their artillery, killing four people, and where in March of last year the Korean frigate was sunk, killing 46 sailors. So he, Defense Minister Kim, went right back to where the incident was and had a you know, a major live fire exercise to make his point.
Interesting. Well, I got about 90 seconds left, Juan. Can you tell me how you think the United States should quickly respond going forward?
I don't think the United States should try to reward North Korea by giving them an opportunity for more talks, but I think it does make sense for all of the members of the six-party discussion to get back and try to talk about it. And I think, you know, South Korea and China have, you know, made it clear that that's the way forward. You know, of course, South Korea has conditioned that on North Korea renouncing its nuclear program.
Well, we're going to have to wrap things up there. Juan Kim talking about the challenges we face on a global scale with the ambitions of North Korea. We'll be back next Thursday with another great episode of Capital Thinking. Until then, have a great weekend.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.